Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. For decades, much of Appalachia's economy has rested on the boom and bust cycles of industries like coal and manufacturing. So are there industries that might one day provide more financial stability to the region? This week, we'll learn more about some unexpected and unique ways Appalachians earn money, like growing industrial hemp.
This is something that can start making some people some money. I'd like to see Eastern Kentucky to be a big grower of hemp, you know, as a whole.
And we'll take a look inside the black walnut industry and meet some people who earn extra cash by helping harvest this plentiful Appalachian food.
Every aspect of walnut hauling, from the picking up to loading it onto the semi-truck at the end of the season, is a lot of work and takes a lot of energy.
And we'll hear the conclusion to Derek Acow's story, the very final installment of our Struggle to Stay series. Derek has big dreams for his home of Harlan County, Kentucky.
They put some wind fields up in these mountains like that, I'm telling you. Then I think business would be booming. Literally just cover that up right there with just wind or solar.
But does Derek find a way to make his dreams a reality in Kentucky? We'll find out in this episode of Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. When you hear the words Appalachian economy, what comes to mind, really? Tobacco? Coal? Textiles? It's true that these industries have long put bread on the Appalachian table, but as those industries have faded in recent decades, jobs have grown scarce. Now faced with tough challenges, people in Appalachia are depending more on what was once considered side jobs, while others are thinking outside the box to find ways to earn money that may surprise you. Today, we'll take a closer look at some unexpected economic experiments that just may be paving the way for a more diversified Appalachian economy down the road. We'll start in West Virginia, where one source of energy, coal, tends to dominate discussions about the economy. But it's another form of energy production that brought the world's Jason Margolis to the state. In this story, Margolis introduces us to the minds and muscles behind Solar Holler, a business that's banking on a bright future for solar energy in Appalachia.
Tanner Lee Swagger graduated from high school this spring. His father and his grandfather both worked in West Virginia's coal industry. I asked Swagger if any of his classmates were going the coal route.
No.
None.
What are most of your friends doing now?
Honestly, working. I know fast food, and we're not working at all.
We have those new socket adapters.
Yeah.
All right, sounds good.
I met Swagger at his job installing rooftop solar panels. He says his family is delighted.
Oh, they love it. They're happy. They're excited that I'm actually doing something different. You know, a lot of people ain't doing this in West Virginia. A lot of people's against it, actually. A lot of people want to go back to coal.
And obviously you're not against it, right?
No, I ain't against it. I love solar. It's way better than coal, I think.
Solar panels can save people money on their electricity bills and cut down on greenhouse gas emissions, which fuel climate change. Swagger is working as an apprentice with Solar Holler. 32-year-old Dan Conant founded the company 4 years ago. He doesn't see solar and coal at odds with each other.
The way I think about it as a West Virginian is that West Virginia has always been an energy state, and this is just the next step.
Don't let the accent fool you. He's a native.
I've been told so many times that you don't sound like a West Virginian because I don't have a thick twang or, yeah.
Conant left his job at the U.S. Department of Energy to start Solar Holler to try to help slow his state's economic slide.
Mingo County, West Virginia, which is where I think three of our crew members are coming out of today, they've lost more than 40% of all the jobs in the entire county in the past 4 years.
Only about 12,000 West Virginians work in coal mining today, a 90% decline over two generations. President Trump has made bringing back coal jobs an outsized part of his Make America Great Again platform. Conant is grateful for the spotlight on the economic plight of Appalachia, but he doesn't see a return to the good old days either.
We need to find new things. It's not going to be the coal industry of the past. The industry has been so automated. Strip mining doesn't take the number of people that guys with headlamps and pickaxes did.
Solar may be an energy of tomorrow, but coal jobs pay much better. Solar panel installers earn about $12 an hour. Coal mining jobs here typically pay more than double that. But those jobs are increasingly hard to find, and Solar Hauler needs workers now. It's setting up a training center in an old abandoned factory in Huntington, West Virginia. Deacon Stone with Solar Hauler shows me around.
This was Corbin Clothing Manufacturer. They made some of the finest, like, Mad Men era clothing that you could get straight up from Wall Street, New York City. It was all across the country.
He stops the tour and points at something bizarre. Rows and rows of church pews.
So we're in Appalachia, you know, and you can't throw a rock and not hit a church or a place that will soon be a church, right? So these pews came from a local...
Long story short, they needed seating in a hurry.
And we had no means to purchase chairs, no means to borrow things, and it was just like we're sweating. And I pass by and I see these pews, and it's like deep discount if you take them all.
Solar Hauler is partnering with a nonprofit called the Coalfield Development Corporation. They own the building. Beyond solar jobs, they're teaching former coal workers skills like woodworking and farming. Apprentices with Coalfield Development work 33 hours and spend 6 hours a week at a community college. About 90 people have entered the program. Brandon Dennison is the group's CEO.
Coal is more than just an employment base here in Appalachia. I mean, it's central to our identity. And that lets you know a sense of our pain the last few years. No one industry can replace coal, nor should it. We need to diversify and have lots of different business opportunities.
Half of Coalfield Development's funding, nearly $2 million, comes from a federal program called the Appalachian Regional Commission. It was created by an act of Congress in 1965 at the urging of Presidents John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson to combat the region's high levels of poverty. The Trump administration wants to defund it. Dennison says that worries him a lot.
If we lost our Appalachian Regional Commission funding, we would have to basically cut our scale of impact in half.
Here's how the mayor of Huntington sees potential funding cuts.
Well, it's stupid.
Steve Williams is a Democrat and is running for Congress next year. Proponents of the Appalachian Regional Commission say it's helped dramatically cut rural poverty, improve regional health care and education. Opponents say it's a waste of taxpayer money. President Trump's budget calls for the elimination of, quote, unnecessary federal funding, citing a 1996 government study casting doubt on the commission's effectiveness. President Ronald Reagan also tried to defund it repeatedly, by the way. Mayor Williams says pulling the plug on the Appalachian Regional Commission would send a clear message.
That says to me that they're giving up on this area.
For now, Congress has voted to restore the program's funding through the end of the year. Dan Conant, the founder of Solar Hauler, stays clear of politics. He's interested in market economics. And at the end of the day, he thinks he's betting on a winner.
Within a week of cutting the ribbon on our very first project, we got so much interest around the state that we outstripped the capacity of everybody who knew how to install solar in West Virginia at that point.
Conant says he's currently backed up on 16 projects. And he needs trained workers to get things moving along. For The World, Jason Margolis, Lewisburg, West Virginia.
And I'm Jessica Lilly. You're listening to Inside Appalachia, where we're talking about some of the unexpected new enterprises putting cash in the pockets of 21st century Appalachians. Now we turn to the dark horse of Appalachia's new economy, industrial hemp. Despite the fact that it's still officially classified as a Schedule I controlled substance, recent changes in federal policy have opened up the door for pilot programs to test out the viability of hemp as an agricultural commodity. Rachel Kramer from our partners at WGBH and the Ground Truth Project brings us the story from Kentucky.
On a hot Friday afternoon in September, Neil Spears drives off a paved road through a creek and up to his friend's hemp farm near Pikeville, Kentucky. It's nestled among the ancient mountains of Appalachia.
I used to tell everybody in Colorado, they'd talk about the mountains in Colorado. So well, you all got majestic mountains. We've got beautiful mountains. It's two different things. Awe-inspiring and beautiful is two different things.
Spears has a goatee and hair that brushes his shoulders. He walks through the five-acre plot in his beat-up straw hat, watching out for rattlesnakes. It's not easy to see the hemp plants. Most of this year's crop has been choked out by weeds.
It's not what I dreamed of. But first year out, you got a crop up. You know, albeit a small crop, we got a crop up.
Spears grew up in Pikeville, pursued a career as a singer songwriter, and eventually left to work in the marijuana industry in Colorado.
A good friend of mine said, you want to come home and get ready for what's coming and start growing hemp? I said, yeah. So came back last November, and here we are.
Hemp can be used for a wide range of products, plastics, health foods, biofuels. Spears and his friend plan on selling the fiber part of the crop to a processing facility in North Carolina later this fall. But the most lucrative product is cannabidiol oil, or CBD oil. Spears is excited about their plan to build a 10,000-square-foot greenhouse to start growing hemp specifically for CBD oil. To be clear, CBD is different from THC, or tetrahydrocannabinol, the chemical in marijuana that gets you high. But some studies suggest it can be used to treat epilepsy, anxiety, and depression. All these claims need more scientific research, but in the meantime, there's a growing market for CBD oil.
We don't want to be the biggest grower in the United States. Don't want to be. But I'd like to see Eastern Kentucky to be a big grower of hemp, you know, as a whole. This is something that can start making some people some money. I'm interested in helping whoever in Eastern Kentucky wants to grow hemp, grow hemp.
But for hemp growers wanting to cash in on cannabidiol oil, there's risk involved. The hemp strains with the highest CBD levels also have higher levels of THC. And if the THC content is more than 0.3%, state law requires the grower to burn the crop. About an hour and a half away in Jackson, researchers at the University of Kentucky are experimenting with creating hemp varieties more suitable for growing in the state.
I don't know how tall this plant is, but planted at the end of June, how tall would it be if it were planted 60 days earlier? We'll find out next year, but that's pretty impressive.
University of Kentucky agronomist David Williams inspects one of his hemp research plots at the Robinson Center for Appalachian Resource Sustainability. The spindly green stalks and the arrow-shaped leaves give off an earthy, slightly sweet smell.
The most important part about our work is determining which varieties are best adapted to our latitudes and our climate for optimum yields.
This research would have been illegal a few years ago. But let's back up. Okay, let's back up a lot. From the sails and rigging on the USS Constitution, America's oldest naval ship, to the canvas uncovered wagons heading out west, hemp is deeply tied to our nation's past. And Kentucky has played a vital role in that. While some was originally grown on small family farms, the majority of the nation's hemp was produced in the bluegrass region of central Kentucky as a plantation crop.
Hemp production is very tedious, very labor intensive. One needs to look not very deeply to understand that that history is inextricably connected to slavery.
Hemp production in Kentucky dropped off after slavery was abolished and cheaper imported fibers became available. Except for a short-lived revival during World War II, hemp production was discouraged and finally banned because of its connection to marijuana. Cannabidiol oil from hemp cannot get you high, but it was still grouped in the same category as marijuana and heroin. Then came the 2014 Farm Bill, which allowed certain states to grow hemp for the first time in about six decades. A number of Kentucky lawmakers said hemp would create thousands of jobs, and the Kentucky Department of Agriculture launched an aggressive research program. Agronomist David Williams.
By most measures, Kentucky leads the nation in industrial hemp research. It has nothing to do with me as a scientist, UK as an entity, or all the farmers that are involved. The Kentucky Department of Agriculture has done a fantastic job managing what anyone would consider a very complex situation.
And it is complex. Those who want to grow or process hemp need a license from the Drug Enforcement Administration, and hemp seeds and plants cannot be taken across state lines. Still, there were about 200 approved growers this year in Kentucky who, in total, planted almost 3,000 acres of industrial hemp. Some was for fiber, which includes everything from t-shirts to dashboards, but most of it was for cannabidiol oil. Almost all the hemp production was in central and western Kentucky, where the average farm is much larger, 100 acres or more. In the eastern, more mountainous side of the state, farms are smaller than 10 acres.
We can't expect eastern Kentucky and West Virginia to become major contributors to hemp as a commodity crop. That being said, plant breeding or certified seed production. And now we're talking situations where you don't have to have hundreds thousands of acres to be profitable.
In other words, Williams says Eastern Kentucky doesn't have the terrain to grow hemp for large-scale industrial products, but producers in the region could potentially grow hemp for the seeds or seedlings and sell those to farmers in the central and western part of the state. With limited flatland, some entrepreneurs thought former strip mines could become farms.
Hemp has this reputation of being a very hardy plant that will grow just about anywhere. There's a big difference between a plant that will technically grow anywhere versus a plant that you can get profitable production per acre anywhere, you know, based on the types of soils you're working with.
That's Nathan Hall, president of Reclaim Appalachia, a nonprofit working to develop economic opportunities on former coal mining land. He tried growing hemp on an old strip mine site, but it didn't go well.
There is no topsoil at all. You're planting into rock. And so we just experimented with it, and we destroyed equipment, and then we'd weld it back together, and then we destroyed it again, and we'd replace things.
Hall says despite the small size of farms in mountainous eastern Kentucky, growing hemp for CBD oil in the fertile valleys could be economically viable, with a couple of caveats.
We need to get clarity around the legal issues surrounding CBD. It still seems to be a bit undecided in terms of, you know, whether we can sell across state lines, you know, with the current administration, you know, whether certain things like CBD may be deemed illegal at some point. You know, there's just a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of risk.
Despite those risks, Neil Spears from Pikeville is willing to bet on it.
This is about helping people. This is about making people better. It's about making this area better.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Rachel Kramer in Pikeville, Kentucky.
This story came to us from Crossing the Divide, a cross-country reporting road trip from WGBH and the Ground Truth Project. Rachel Kramer is on a team of five reporters exploring issues that divide us and stories that unite us. Follow their trip across America at xthedivide.org. In a minute, we'll hear about another agricultural crop that may surprise you to learn grows right here in Appalachia, tea. But is there a market for it? We'll find out after the break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're exploring unexpected jobs and industries that are cropping up across the region as more traditional sources of wealth taper off. Now let's travel down to a small Appalachian community in South Carolina called Pickens, where Jason Margolis introduces us to a man who's trying to revive the area's economy with a product that's associated with a very different part of the world, tea.
Steve Lorch is a surgical nurse. His other job is running a tea farm. His company, Table Rock Tea, began innocently enough with one plant. He had started a clean water project in Kenya, where he fell in love with all things tea.
So I came home and bought a plant online and stuck it in our backyard in our subdivision where we were living, and it happened to grow. And this is actually that plant. We call this one Big Daddy. And this is the one that sort of started the whole thing.
He and his wife moved to the countryside, then decided to grow a hedge made from tea plants.
By the time we got up to about 400 or 500, we started thinking, well, how much does this produce every year? Why don't we just start a tea company?
Lorch and his wife are now 4 years into their business plan. He says that's the rocky phase, the proof of concept.
We had to first see, well, can we grow tea out here? And then is it reproducible? And then will it make good tea? Because if any of those answers were no, there was no reason to expand into a commercial greenhouse and all that kind of stuff.
All signs pointed to yes, so the expansion was on.
Oh, this is our handy-dandy Cushman golf cart that we use for work around the farm, but we also give tours in it, too. So hang on.
Lorch took me on a ride around the property.
It's 17 acres. Eventually, we'll expand to 30. And there's no telling how far we'll expand when the consortium goes full blast.
The consortium is other locals. Lorch's vision is to sell young plants to his neighbors. They'll harvest them, then sell the tea leaves back to Lorch. Right now, he has six neighbors on board. In 30 years, though, he'd like upstate South Carolina to be to American-grown tea what Napa is to American wine. This might sound wildly optimistic, but is it? Let's turn to James Norwood Pratt in San Francisco, author of many books about tea. I asked him, where are the world's finest teas grown today? I was looking for a geographic answer. That's not what Pratt offered.
The world's best tea, Jason, is grown where people take the most care of the plant and its leaf in regions that are particularly favorable to that plant's growth. And so it could quite possibly come from Pickens, South Carolina.
Pouring his own cup, Pratt says growing quality tea takes three basic things.
You need, Jason, heaven, earth, and man.
You need the right soils, climate, and knowledgeable people to produce great tea. If they can pull this off in Pickens, South Carolina, Patrick Lark would love it. He's president of the Pickens Revitalization Association. Pickens has a familiar Appalachian small town story, a place that got left behind as work shifted to cheaper foreign labor.
This area was just so entrenched with textiles for years that that just kind of left a void here.
Lark is from Pickens. He's 40 now and calls Pickens an ideal place to grow up, a storybook small town. You want to know how small? During our interview, a truck rolled by outside, and without turning to look, Lark said, "That's Danny Adams."
Is one of the guys that lives towards the end of town, and I know he was coming to check on his parents who lived down the street from the chamber office here.
How would you know it was his truck?
Just by the sound. It's a small town.
Pickens seems like a nice place, but it needs jobs. I asked Lark if he really thinks his town could become the next great tea spot, and along with that, bring employment.
It's one of those things that off the cuff, you just kind of scratch your head and go, well, how's this going to work? And then you go meet with Steve and see what he's got going on, and you just can't help but buy in.
Back in his garage, Lorch shows off what he calls his microfactory. A machine separates dried leaves, then heat seals them into tea bags. The garage is filled with cool-looking machines. Because there's not much of a tea industry in the U.S., it can be hard to find the right equipment. So the Lorches had to get creative.
My wife used to work at Subway Subs, and she said, hey, that's just a proofing oven.
It's now their tea oxidizer.
Yeah. In fact, if you look on the back, it says Subway.
No question, Lorch is facing a lot of challenges. He knows it. His biggest challenge, though, may not be growing the right leaves or processing them just right. It's the basic economics.
My statistics might be a little bit off on this, but last I had checked, I think a Sri Lankan picker gets about $3 to $5 a day.
There's just no way Lorch can compete with that. So he'll have to grow better tea and charge more for it. His long-term strategy includes exporting to the world's great tea countries.
Someone in China who's looking for a rare tea would find it in a U.S.-grown tea.
Who knows? His boxes labeled Hillbilly, America's native tea, with a cartoon of a guy and his dog moonshining tea, that just might sound exotic to someone halfway around the world. I did some informal polling of British, Chinese, and Sri Lankan tea drinkers and asked if they'd buy tea from South Carolina. One Sri Lankan responded via email, ha ha, ha ha ha. I also called the Chinese tea company in London and spoke with founder Juan Webster. She says Chinese teas are the best, but she thinks Chinese consumers might give South Carolina a chance.
It's hard to say. I think for people who are willing to try, see what flavor like. I think Chinese are quite open to that.
But the brand name Hillbilly, that didn't register.
No idea. Hillbilly. How do you spell?
H-I-L-L-B-I-L-L. So perhaps not a selling point, at least not yet. Still, Steve Lorch is just getting started. And if he can create an extraordinary tea, and he believes he can, maybe the sales and the jobs will follow. For The World, Jason Margolis, Pickens, South Carolina.
I'm Jessica Lilly. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. As we were preparing for this show about innovative jobs in Appalachia, we heard from some of our listeners. Danielle Costello wrote to us, and she says she's a freelance writer, editor, who moved back to her home state of West Virginia after building a freelance career in Memphis, Tennessee. She says it's a different market here in Appalachia and definitely a struggle. Most of her work still comes from out of state. Danielle hopes change is coming, especially in Morgantown, West Virginia, where she lives. And Matt wrote us saying he works as a landman for a privately owned natural gas company in Bridgeport, West Virginia. He sent us this audio message.
I looked into other industries during my most recent job search, but none in our area came close to paying what I can make in this job, as long as I actually have this job. One more downturn resulting in a layoff will probably send my family out of the area in search of different opportunities, which is terrifying to me. I'm 34, with about a decade of experience in this fairly specialized role. I think that the oil and gas industry will be in Appalachia for a long time. But the nature of this business means that the actual companies and individual workers may change almost yearly, making it a tough income source to plan for over the long term for any given family.
And native West Virginian Anna Harsh runs a dance company in Wheeling. She left West Virginia to go to college, but returned home to start her own dance company. But it's been a challenge for her to afford to stay.
It's hard to find a job at a college where they offer dance. Many colleges can't afford to add professors to their staff. Physical education is not a priority for many of the schools or smaller colleges. So I do what most West Virginians do. I make it work. I take on part-time jobs, retail jobs. And of course, I try to work as a freelance choreographer for various high schools here, as well as teach dance and fitness classes at schools, studios, and even the resorts. But doing all of those jobs plus running a full-time company is a challenging experience and time-consuming. We artists want to work and focus on our creativity full-time. My hope for the Mountain State is to keep growing and thinking of ways outside the box for us to remain living here.
What about you? How do you make a living? Do you struggle? Do you work multiple jobs to pay your bills? Did you make a career shift? Do you know of a unique way to earn extra cash? We want to hear from you. Send us a tweet at InAppalachia or send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. Today we're hearing about some of the unique ways people in Appalachia are working to earn a living during a time of economic uncertainty in the region. We heard about people who are growing hemp and tea. Now we'll hear about one food that you may eat in holiday brownies or cookies, a food that's actually quite plentiful in our mountains. I'm talking about black walnuts, and every fall our forests are thick with them. You may have seen them laying around on the ground. They're these green, tennis ball-sized nuts that rain onto fields, roads, and sometimes people. They can be dangerous, and their inky juice stains everything they touch. But here's something I just learned about walnuts. You can actually earn a bit of cash by collecting them. Eileen Gua has this story about black walnut pickers in Appalachia.
The first car arrived over 2 hours before the hauling station officially opened in Jeffersonville, Kentucky. By the time the hauling starts at 8 o'clock on Saturday night, four more vehicles are already in line under a darkening sky. Some of the drivers stand under the bright lights of the tent that protects the machinery from rain and snow. Others sit waiting patiently inside their own cars. Caitlin Hartfield and her parents are the first ones in line.
We've been waiting here since around 5:30. We wanted to get here early so that it'd be easier to just go through them.
Black walnuts grow in the wild, and harvesters like the Hartfields look for them everywhere. In their yards, their neighbors' yards, on the sides of the roads, in forest land. Once they've gathered all that they can fit into their vehicles, they bring the nuts to one of 238 hauling stations in 14 states across the country. There, Hullers remove the outer shells, weigh the walnuts.
We got a total of 700 and some pounds.
Purchase them.
$75.49.
And send them to Stockton, Missouri, home of Hammond's Product Company. Hammond's has been selling black walnut products for 71 years.
My grandfather started the company in 1946.
That's Brian Hammond's, the company president.
He was a grocery store owner and operator, and he started by getting a little cracking machine and simply cracking the wild nuts that people brought in.
From the humble beginnings in his grandfather's grocery store, the family business has grown into the largest commercial black walnut sheller in the world, putting out an average of 23 million pounds a year. The shelled black walnuts are used by home cooks and chefs in their raw form. They also appear in products like black walnut ice cream and black walnut oil. And even the shells themselves can be used as a sandblasting agent in water filtration systems, even in sports fields. But what really makes black walnuts unique is how they are gathered, and the financial benefits that spread to their network of harvesters and hulling stations.
We're paying the highest price ever of $15 per 100 pounds, or 15 cents a pound, and we pay a commission to the hulling operator.
That commission is 5 cents a pound. And with the bumper crop in Appalachia this year, Brian Hammonds thinks the 2017 harvest will be somewhere in the range of $30 million.
That's about $6 million that's put directly into local economies.
Including $675,000 into Appalachia. That's for about 4.5 million pounds of black walnuts. Not that any of these harvesters or hullers are getting rich off the trade. Renee and William Zahari run the hulling station in Jeffersonville from a modest 5-acre property that also houses an animal rescue. Black walnut hulling is their main source of income.
Every aspect of walnut hulling, from the picking up to loading it onto the semi-truck at the end of the season, is a lot of work and takes a lot of energy.
Is it enough to sustain you for the rest of the year?
It is, in that we are very economical.
The key for both haulers like the Zaharis, as well as for pickers, is speed. And Ronnie Carpenter has the method down. Carpenter is a lifelong black walnut picker. He's here tonight with his girlfriend. They're in a beat-up SUV with sacks of black walnuts everywhere. In the back seat, the trunk, even tied down onto his visibly sagging roof.
My name is Ronnie Carpenter. I got black walnuts. I got 18 on top, and I got about 15 in the back here.
Carpenter says that it only took them 2.5 hours to gather all those nuts.
I get them on trees, I shake trees. She pick them up, put them in a sack for me.
He also has some advice for other potential walnut pickers.
Money do grow on trees. They didn't lie out there.
Carpenter doesn't have a job, so this money that grows on trees is his main source of income. He says that he's getting too old for the black walnut business, but in the meantime, the nuts just keep falling, and someone has to pick them. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Eileen Guo.
Eileen is a print journalist with 100 Days in Appalachia, which is a collaborative publication between West Virginia Public Broadcasting, WVU's Media Innovation Center, and The Daily Yonder. We're happy to share Eileen's first audio story right here on Inside Appalachia. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. Black walnuts may be practically raining down from the sky in your neck of the woods, but if you buy them in the grocery store, they're not cheap. All those holiday meals take quite a lot of cash and planning. Are you feeling the financial squeeze? To help you out, we bring you another installment in our occasional series called Appetite Appalachia.
Corn, bread, butter, beans, and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able.
Our series, Appetite Appalachia, highlights foods and recipes with Appalachian roots. As we head into the season of holiday cooking, you may be planning your next big meal to cook for your friends and family. Cooking healthy for a crowd can be expensive, but it doesn't have to be. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Kara Lofton takes us from store to kitchen in this story on ways to cook good food for the holidays without forking over half your paycheck.
At the Walmart in Huntington, nutritionist Michaela Hart is talking about food.
So if we think about like vegetables and that kind of thing,
One thing for sure that we could do, instead of doing like fresh vegetables up here in the produce area, we could do canned vegetables or we could do frozen vegetables. Those typically at this time of the year in particular are a lot cheaper than, you know, buying fresh.
We walk past piles of apples and bagged lettuce to compare prices on green beans.
So let's see, here's some green beans. Now this is organic, so that's going to be, let's see, here's something right here. This is just the Walmart brand, so this is market side. It is $2.48 for 12 ounces.
Hart says there is a perception that eating healthy is expensive, but it doesn't have to be. Eating seasonally, cooking from scratch, and meal prepping are all ways to keep costs down. By this point, we've meandered away from fresh produce and are looking for some canned green beans.
Okay, now let's see if we can find our green beans.
There you go. Yes.
Okay. So let's see. This is 38 ounces for $1.64. The other one was 12 ounces for $2.48. So yeah, so here's one that, and to, I mean, canned and fresh, they have the same vitamins and minerals. So, you know, a green bean's a green bean. It doesn't matter if it's in a can or if it's fresh.
It's not just about checking prices, Hart says, but also making sure you don't get caught up in buying what you don't need.
The very first thing is that you want to make a list. You want to make a kind of like a plan of what you're going to have for the meal. And then write down, you know, all the ingredients or the dishes that you're wanting to have. And then stick to the list.
And one good way to have a list is to make a menu. At Cafe Semino in Sutton, chefs Oscar Aguilar and Tim Urbanek are prepping for lunch. The restaurant at Cafe Semino is popular for providing some of the best fine dining in West Virginia. But Aguilar says eating well can be as simple as sticking with the staples.
For example, for one, you can go to a grocery store and get a whole chicken. It's like $6, $7, and that's enough for like four people or more. And then like just get some sweet potatoes, just much sweet potatoes and green beans. You can get fresh green beans for like $2 a pound.
Aguilar says this menu, including a rice pudding dessert, would cost around $19 for a family of four, or just under $5 a meal. He starts on his second menu.
And you can get like 2 pounds of pork for like $5. And beets, you can get beets right now too for like a couple bucks, you know, in a store, 2-3 beets. And also I have regular potatoes in here too that pretty reasonable also, and kale.
I stopped him here. Beets and kale are not exactly classic West Virginia food. Owner Tim Urbanek pushed back.
Well, one of the things that you do to try to be healthy is you change your lifestyle, okay? And if you really, really can't eat the beets, then you probably don't want to eat them. But if you don't eat the beets just because you just never thought about it or you never really had it in your menu planning, this would be a good place to put it in because you change what you do. If you're overweight, you change what you do in your diet to lose a few pounds.
Urbanek says it's not just about adding new things into your diet that will make the difference, but actually spending time in the kitchen making food from scratch. He says you might find not only appreciation for new taste, but that returning to the kitchen, especially around the holidays, will make cooking an activity the whole family can do together. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from WVU Medicine, Charleston Area Medical Center, and Marshall Health.
Goodbye, don't you cry, I'm going to Louisiana. Bye, dog, and the big fat hog, and Mary Susanna. Sing song, ding dong, gonna take a trip to China. Cornbread and butter beans, and there to Carolina.
Yeah. Cornbread and butter beans, and you.
And now for our final story, we'll hear the conclusion to our 8-month series, The Struggle to Stay. Today we'll hear the final chapter of Derek Acal's Struggle to Stay. Derek is from a coal camp town called Lynch in Harlan County, Kentucky. If you haven't caught his earlier stories, here's a quick recap. Derek says he wants to leave Eastern Kentucky to find work. A few years ago, he moved away on a college football scholarship, but then a neck injury led him to move back home.
We learned that a combination of dreams, booms, busts, and racism have led Derek's ancestors and many members of Lynch's African-American community to move away, generation after generation. The last time we heard from Derek, he was planning to move to California.
I'm from this small town. There's no careers here. And I feel like if I moved out to California, that's where I might have a future. You know, I'm 21. You know, I know I'm young, but I'm ready to get out there and do a lot.
But to do that, he needs to save up enough money. Now, more than a year after Benny Becker, reporter for the Ohio Valley Resource and WMMT, began following Derek, we'll hear if Derek's been able to make his plan work.
Derek first got the idea to move out west when he heard that there were jobs working on oil rigs.
The oil industry is like the coal mines down here, but the only thing that's different is that the oil rigs and stuff are like going crazy.
Derek visited California over New Year's, and once he got there, he learned about other jobs he could get in the energy industry.
The solo job in California, you start out, you know, $23 an hour. You know, that is so much money.
He also learned about job opportunities in the world of fashion.
I can get down with a modeling job down there and make as much money as a coal miner easily.
I met up with Derek in January, soon after he came back from California. I went to the house he was living in with his mom, grandma, and little brother. It was cold outside, so we sat in the living room on a big cozy couch. Derek told me that visiting California had made him even more committed to finding a way to move there.
What kind of timeline are you thinking for trying to actually make the move?
I'm gonna be leaving in the summer before June 12th. All you gotta do is just get some money, get a plane ticket, and I'm already there.
The next time I met up with Derek, the weather had warmed up, so we sat outside.
It's March 21st, 2017. We are on my front porch in Lynch, Kentucky.
At that time, he said he was still on track to move in June.
2.5 more months and I'm already out of here.
But he still hadn't saved enough money for his move out west. He was having a hard time finding work in Harlan County.
Literally just going after job, putting applications everywhere. They wouldn't pick you up anywhere.
Derek did find one way to earn a little income. He has his uncle's pair of hair clippers, and he's learned how to use them.
I got a booming business right now, cutting people's hair.
2.5 months later, I sat down again with Derek on his front porch in Lynch.
Today would be the day that I'll be going to California right now.
Derek told me he needed to find some better paying work. He'd done another big round of job applications and even gotten a new buzz cut in hopes that it would help him get hired. At one point, Derek happened to look at a picture of himself from before he cut off his hair, and he told me that just looking at it made him sad.
Man, I'm telling you, every time I see my long hair, I just miss my hair even more.
Even with short hair, Derek still couldn't find any steady work. But he stayed hopeful, and he made the most of a beautiful summer. He wasn't making much money, but he had time to spend with his family and to enjoy the natural beauty of Harlan County.
Like, all these mountains all the way around here. Like, I literally been all over these mountains, fishing, snake hunting. That's really what I spend most of my time at, is on Black Mountain.
The top of Black Mountain, just above Lynch, is the highest point in Kentucky. The next time I visited Derek, that's where we went.
My name is Derek A. Cale. It's Tuesday, July 11th, and we are on top of Black Mountain. And there's a memorial right here to let you know that you're 4,139 feet.
You can see pretty far into Virginia from the overlook, and most of the view is forested ridgelines. But there's one big area that dominates the view and looks more like a moonscape. It's a mountaintop removal site.
Looking over where that strip mine is at, you know, even though it killed that mountain, you know, it's still beautiful to me.
For Derek, part of the beauty is in the possibility he sees in the big flat area that coal mining left behind.
If they put some wind fields over these mountains like that, I'm telling you. Then I think business would be booming. Literally just cover that up right there with just wind or solar.
If something like that were to happen, would you consider coming back if there were suddenly all these jobs in wind and solar here?
Yeah, most definitely, yeah. They have all that stuff right there, yeah, most definitely.
But that's not what's happening.
All the kids that I grew up with, you know, we all leaving because there's no jobs here, but without coal, You know, the town is just going to be a ghost town.
I wonder, like, if you have feelings about if any of that makes it more important for people to hear your voice, or how you feel about your voice and your story fitting into all of the kinds of voices and stories that end up out there on the media.
I feel like I'm representing the people that's all around here, you know, that want to say what they're going through, but they can't say it because they have no way of saying it, you know.
I recorded this interview in July, and by this point, Derek had given up on finding a job in Harlan County. He'd moved on to another backup plan.
Around here, there's just nothing here, so I'm just going to pack up and go to Georgia.
Derek has family and friends who've moved from Lynch to the Atlanta area. He has an aunt who offered to let him stay at her house and help him get a job nearby so that he could save the money he needs to move to California.
This week will be my last week, you know, down here. But I'm going to be visiting like crazy, though, because I'm a really big mama's and grandma's boy. And I love my brother to death, so I can't leave him.
The next few months, Derek kept busy in Atlanta, working and saving money. I caught up with him by phone in early November, about 10 months after he started trying to save money to move out west.
Hello?
Hey, Derek?
Yes?
Hey,
how you doing?
Doing all right. How are you? How's it going?
It's been crazy, I'll tell you that.
Derek's been in Georgia for about 2 months. He's been living outside Atlanta with his aunt, working for a power company, and hanging out with Vince, the friend he's planning to move to California with. Derek tells me things had been going pretty smoothly until this last week. That's when he learned that his boss had been pocketing some of the money he was supposed to have gotten. He quit that job, but he says he's already got leads for a new job and he's still planning to move to California.
Oh, yeah, well, most definitely. I'm going to be leaving here pretty soon, probably like in January or February. What I'm basically doing is just working to get my ticket and everything and to get a car. Even though my boss owes me money and everything, which I'm going to get, you know, I've been saving up quite a bit of money, so I've been doing good with that.
Derek tells me the response he's gotten from people hearing his story has also helped him to feel good about how things are going.
There's been a lot of people that messaged me and talking about how much I inspired them. It's people that I don't even know, and they're telling me about their situations and stuff like that, what they want to do. It's like the people that are scared to do something message me, who are scared to go out their comfort zone.
Is there something you'd want to say in your own voice to people out there listening?
I just tell them to never give up. Never give up on your dreams, because I'm still on my dreams, and I'm not far from them. You just got to have the patience to chase your dream, because it's not going to always come to you just as quick. And like I say, always have a couple plans with you, because there's always going to be some situations that's going to switch up your dreams.
Derek Akal's Struggle to Stay was produced by Benny Becker from WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and the Ohio Valley Resource. This story concludes our Struggle to Stay series. We hope you've enjoyed following these people as they've tried to find a home and feel settled. It seems kind of fitting that we end the series with a show about entrepreneurship and jobs. Each of the people we followed in the Struggle to Stay series is looking for a way to make money and to survive. Since this series began, we've received a number of messages from listeners who say they struggle in similar ways. We've heard why some people say they want to remain around family, friends, and loved ones. But sometimes making money means leaving. Sometimes, as we've heard in this series, people determine that the value of relationships is greater than earning a big income. How about you? Do you struggle to stay in Appalachia? If you've left, have you struggled to return home? You can send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Oh, and we'll be checking in with all six of the people we've been following, Colt, Mark, Kira, Crystal, Dave, and Derek. And later this year, we'll hear from them again and see how they've been doing lately. You can listen to all of the stories from the Struggle to Stay series on our website at wvpublic.org. Just one more thing before I let you go. Steve Earle was in West Virginia earlier this year to play on Mountain Stage. So this week, as sort of a holiday gift, we wanted to share his iconic song, Copperhead Road, with you. After all, Thanksgiving is a time for coming home and spending time with people who you'd know would have your back if you got stuck down a holler like Copperhead Road. Also, I really like this song, so here's Copperhead Road by Steve Earle, as heard on Mountain Stage.
ain't Johnny Pettimore. Same as my daddy and his daddy before. How they ever saw granddaddy out here? Only come a ten about twice a year. Buy a 100 pennies to the copper mine. Every mama knew he made moonshine. Now the revenue man on the granddaddy bed. Up, I lost everything I had. For my time, but I've been told never come back from Copper Redwood. Now, daddy run a whiskey and a bib like that. The ship painted on the side. Shot a coat of primer and a look inside. Well, him and my uncle told the engine man. I still remember that number and the sound. And the ship come around the middle of the night. Heard Mama crying, son wasn't right. Didn't have a lot of wind to weep the loo. Smell the whiskey burning, I come for you.
And wherever the holidays take you, we hope you have safe journeys. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. The fiddle music you heard in today's show is from the archived field recordings at the Augusta Heritage Center, recorded in the 1990s by Jerry Milnes. Other music in today's show was provided by Marisa Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, Dr. Turtles, and Heroes Are Gang Leaders. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Appalachia Health News, the Ohio Valley Resource, which is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting, PRI's The World and Their 50 States series, The Ground Truth Project, and 100 Days in Appalachia. Our Appetite Appalachia theme music is by the Carolina Sunshine Trio. Roxy Todd and I produced Inside Appalachia. Catherine Moore edited our show this week. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. Remember, you can listen to this episode and many others on the Inside Appalachia podcast. Find it at wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.